welcome listeners to Connect the Dots. I'm Allison Rose Levy, and we're here every Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. Each week on Connect the Dots, we connect the dots between our well-being as individuals, families, community members, and citizens of this society, and the well-being of the Earth and our society, and all of the people of the world. So each week on the show, we cover different facets of that with different thought leaders, scientists, activists, advocates, filmmakers, organizers, authors, and all kinds of other people. I'm a longstanding journalist of food, health, and the environment, covering these topics on the Progressive Radio for the last 8 years, as well as in various online progressive media outlets that include Alternet, Truthdig, Truthout, The Huffington Post, Tom Dispatch, EcoWatch, and many more. On today's show, if you listened to last week's show, we did a replay of a show that had run in December of 2014 with someone whom I respected, admired very much, who recently passed in the last 2 weeks. And that was environmentalist Bob Goff, and I'll be telling you a little bit more about him. On today's show, I'm really honored to welcome his daughter's stepdaughter, Lynn Colombe, and she will be sharing her reminiscences about Bob, as well as talking about some of the outstanding work he was doing. So a little background on both of them. If you listened to last week's show, you may already be familiar with Bob. He was an environmentalist and tribal elder, an attorney specializing in cultural ecology, who had worked with Indian tribes on cultural and natural resource issues over the past 30 years. The show last week, if you haven't heard it, it's available in the Connect to Dots archive, was on why Indigenous communities are serving on the front lines of environmental activism. He had so much to say on that show that if you haven't heard it, I, you know, warmly encourage you to give a listen. And, of course, this being recorded in December of 2014, this was before the Standing Rock uprising, you know, which, I mean, the connection between our Indigenous communities and environmental action is something that really came to people's attention thanks to that uprising in 2016. We'll be discussing that more today as well, but it's not news to people from Indigenous and Native backgrounds who have been on the forefront, you know, for decades, if not centuries, because as we can see in this terrible time that we're living in, the awareness of our complete mutual interdependence and, you know, foundational reliance on the earth is something that, you know, our Western technological culture has for some reason become profoundly disconnected from, to the point of doing terrible harm to the very foundations for our own lives. So we'll be talking about all of these themes today. I'm delighted to welcome Lynn Colombe. In addition to her family relationship with Bob Goff, she herself has been very active in the Rosebud Sioux Tribe. She is a consultant in the St. Francis School, and is also an editor of, you know, another person in the media, in other words, on the local level in a newspaper that she edits called the Todd County Tribune. And she's also, sorry, Lynn?
No, I was just saying yes, yep, that I've been just the recent, actually, editor just for the past couple of weeks. And so I've not quite full speed with all that yet, but I will be soon.
I bet you will. You've also been working as the president of the St. Francis Indian School Board.
That's also recent. Big transition.
Tell us a little bit more about your background.
Okay.
Yeah, tell us a little bit about the things you've done. Yeah.
Sure. Well, first of all, hello to all of your listeners and to everybody out there that tuned in. And, you know, thank you for inviting me to join your show today. I do appreciate the chance to memorialize Bob, whom I guess I affectionately called Bob Dad. And my background is, you know, I come from a teaching background and started out in my younger part of my career as a high school English teacher and traveled around quite a bit for a number of years. And just in the past 4 years, relocated back here to my home reservation here in Rosebud. And this is also where Bob held a permanent address and a permanent, you know, P.O. box, because he really traveled far and wide. He had no boundaries to where he would travel. So Rosebud has always kind of been his home base since the late 80s, mid 80s. So I guess I was working with the school more in a administrative capacity, program directorship for a while, and then decided to take some time off in 2016. And that was about the same time that everything happened out to Standing Rock. So I was involved with that from the duration of the times that most of the tribes started to show up in August of 2016 until everything came to a close by probably the first part of April of 2017. And then I had a couple of months to transition back to, I guess, what we would call real life. And in that time, I ran for the tribal school board, which is elected by the tribal members of the Rosebud Sioux Tribe. And we have a annual election. And so I was fortunate enough to be elected by my fellow peers and probably former students, I would imagine. But and then last week we had our swearing in, and then amongst my peers, I was nominated and elected the president of the school board. So
cool.
I'm now, yeah, in training to be the editor of our local newspaper and also going to be doing a little bit of, I guess, politics.
Well, good. That sounds really great. Yeah. You know, I think politics is, in our time, it has to be about raising awareness and getting people involved. And
absolutely.
Yeah, so your incredible background is both an educator and a communicator, and someone very dedicated to your people and to your tribe and to the earth.
Sure.
It's going to be invaluable and important. It's really great. Let's just talk a little bit about Bob. I'm sure that my sort of snapshot description of him doesn't begin to cover. I mean, it just gives a kind of overarching roof to the, you know, kind of enormous space, the different things that fall under that, that he was involved and engaged with. And, you know, you describe his traveling, and I'm sure a lot of that was to you know, be involved in different initiatives, to be in community with friends, to, you know, witness on the ground what was going on in different regions with different allies and all of that. Can you just give our listeners a little bit of a sense of just some of the things? I don't think we should just bombard people with a comprehensive list, because
right.
You probably spent the whole show doing that. But, you
right.
know, just to give a sense, yeah.
Well, you know, growing up here on the Rosebud, we are all pretty homogeneous. Everybody, you know who comes from what family and all this and that. And so any time that we have people from the outside community come in, it's kind of a make it or break it thing. And Bob, you know, definitely became a full part of our community here on the Rosebud. And I first met Bob when I was, I think, 13 years old, and he and my mom were friends and then eventually started dating, and then he became my stepfather probably right before I turned 14 or around that time. And so he was really a big part of my life throughout my entire teenage years and into my college years. And, you know, any time that I would get into trouble, I was like, well, hey, my stepdad's a lawyer, you know, because by then he had become a lawyer. And so sometimes I would even say, my stepdad's a civil rights attorney. Go ahead, you know, try me in different capacities that I had, you know, as a Native woman going through my college education and what have you. But when I first met Bob, he was working for Sinte Gwesha University, and he was the archivist. And I always remember trying to explain that to my friends here on the reservation. They'd say, what does your stepdad do? And I'd be like, he's an archivist. What is that? And so I think a lot of his work in recording a lot of the, I guess, historical artifacts and documents and things like that came into the hands of Sinte Gwesha University, a lot of that has now become an actual museum.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that he, you know, had a good part in doing the background work that led to the really nice museum that the college has now. And then he decided to become an attorney. So we all packed up and moved to Eagan, Minnesota, where we lived for about 3 years, and went along with him while he went through his journey to get his law degree at the University of Minnesota. And by that time, I graduated from high school and was getting into college. And, you know, we had some other family changes going on and whatnot by then. Our little sister, who also is passed now, she came into our lives, you know, and was a part of our lives for 23 years. Also, you know, part of Bob's life as well. And so really, I watched a lot of things happen throughout that time, from being alongside of him putting up wind turbines at the Keeley radio station in Pine Ridge, South Dakota, to, you know, doing work with him and creating some curriculum at one point in time that he needed done for wind energy projects that he was doing across Native America. So everything, you know, I just met people at the funeral who come from the Crazy Horse lineage and who they fought probably for 10 years in the courts over the copyright use of the name Crazy Horse on malt liquor beverages and won. So there was just a lot that he did within this community. And when you stop and think about all the other people outside of Rosebud that he contributed to with, you know, saving everything that has to do with our resources and our earth and just promoting a good stewardship. One of my fun memories of Bob is him always driving a biodiesel car. And he would joke about the police chasing him because he used old donut oil. And so he just had this really wonderful, you know, sense of humor, always equipped, you know, for just about any situation, but just absolutely could not even begin to imagine to try to sum up everything that he has done.
Yeah, he did have a wonderful sense of humor. You know, it's sometimes, you know, it's a challenge to sort of see the things that are going on in our name. I mean, I find this as a reporter. It's just, you know, like, oh, my gosh, you know. But he, and, you know, it's like, and then you have to communicate them. You don't want to be a Demi Downer. On the other hand, you can't be dissociated from, you know, what's going on or what you're reporting on or talking about. But he always had a way to hold it with humor and rigor and sort of warmth of spirit that kind of made it all easier to you know, look at and face up to and get involved with. I mean, I think, and then he was also backstage a lot, doing sort of a lot of legal work and heavy lifting on various initiatives, you know, that, you know, we weren't always aware of. I mean, like, for example, you know, at Standing Rock, when I, you and I first connected because when that was happening, I reached out to Bob and I, without having any details, knew that he must be very much involved. And at the same time, because he and other of our environmental allies and friends and colleagues were, you know, so busy, I didn't want to even, you know, take their time by kind of saying hi or anything, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But I always, and that's when, he, you know, you and I first connected because he suggested I be in touch with you at one point when I wrote him the briefest of emails. Can you give us a picture of, like, what he was actually doing in that struggle at Standing Rock and the legal work, you know, that is still ongoing and all of that? What was his actual role? Like, what was he involved with as far as you know?
Well, Bob was very involved with the legal collective for Sacred Stone Camp, and so directly with LaDonna Allard and the different cases that she was pushing at that time to protect the water and to protect the lands and to enforce that tribes be consulted before major decisions are made over treaty resources or things that would affect tribes even down the river from what, you know, proposed projects are put out to do. And so he worked really closely in that collective of lawyers. He also really linked people into Standing Rock. You know, like you said, he was the link between you and me, you know, between people from the outside who really wanted to be a part of Standing Rock in terms of assisting the struggle or assisting water protectors. He sent a lot of people to me, which was really important because after everything happened with Standing Rock, we find out about all the infiltrations and all of the different people whom we probably associated with who shouldn't have been trusted. And I think through these networks like you went through by going through Bob, that kept the security at a better level for those of us that were working in the camps or who were living in the camps. And so he was one integral link for me in sending me good quality people and resources to assist that. Secondly, he did build a straw bale schoolhouse, and it was completed. And it broke his heart because when we all were forced out of Sacred Stone to do the environmental assessment, which I always found was such an irony that, you know, the Native side spent the entire struggle for 7 or 8 months insisting that the Army Corps of Engineers conduct an environmental assessment of the DAPL project. But at the end of it all, the only people who were ever assessed environmentally were the camps. So, or the campers. And so that was just a huge irony, you know, that came out of the entire movement. Please. But through that, there were bulldozers that actually completely mauled over the school that Bob built. And so some of the toughest news that I've ever had to deliver, you know, throughout the movement was when he asked about the schoolhouse and was when I had to tell him that it was no more, that basically anything that we had there that didn't come off the ground by a go time, it was gone. And that being a semi-permanent structure, it was gone.
Good Lord. You know, I mean, this is so... I mean, you're very kind in calling it ironic, Lynn. I mean, it's actually twisted, hypocritical, and backward to say that the indigenous, you know, kind of low harm you know, very simple kind of community that was built there, you know, or that was there. Much of it had been there, and then it was expanded to accommodate, you know, more people who came to support that. You know, but to call that the environmental risk that had to be inspected or raised, and then to allow this dirty oil, you know, tar sands oil pipeline through water supplies and communities, and, you know, to risk all of the communities downstream who depend on the river, it's just, I mean, I think George Orwell would be, you know, when he talked about doublespeak, you know, this is just, you know, and then people, you know, the people who are in the know realize this is ridiculous.
Right.
But, you know, many other people are confused by it. Oh, they had to do, you know, whatever, an environmental study. Meanwhile, I mean, the fight is still on as to whether the environmental impact of this horrible pipeline, which should have been assessed before, you know, any spoon of dirt was unsettled or any heavy bulldozers, military force, and all the rest of it came into the region. But no, there's no prior assessment. Instead, you know, there's an after-the-fact struggle to take a look at what the impacts are of this. And actually, I recently, in the last month, did an article on Truthout precisely about this and the fact that laws were changed and short-circuited in environmental impact assessments, even under the previous administration, which was when all the ground for this was set, were completely ignored and overruled so that the oil companies could, you know, rush through and do this, and now we were playing catch-up. You know, so
and meanwhile, you know, to add to that, meanwhile, the local laws were then adjusted to support what would otherwise be considered as illegal actions against protesters, you know, to actually criminalize the people who called themselves water protectors. And we saw that, you know, throughout the entire time. The false, I had a good friend of mine that I took to court, and they had him thrown in jail under somebody else's name. And, you know, it was just absolutely crazy once things actually went to court, how, first of all, it was inaccurate in terms of even identifying people properly, but also by the laws that were being changed and created in the interim.
Right, so that they actually, yeah, so here we're talking actually about multiple levels on which laws are changed.
Right.
So while, you know, we're supposed to trust in the law of the land, you know, they're being changed at the local level. They're being changed in terms of criminal activity, you know, is recharacterizing normal participation in democracy. This is not a violent protest, you know, use of military force against Americans and all of that is normalized. And then, you know, without any appropriate environmental review. So all up and down the laws are being changed. And, you know, one of the things that I have noticed in my coverage of this and my coverage overall of environmental stories and in all the conversations and communities with whom I interact is that there's kind of a divide. There are some people who understand what is happening. And then, of course, this year we're seeing ever more dramatically with the hurricanes and storms and floods and fires and really the demolishment of, you know, islands in the Caribbean, huge floods and contamination events in Texas, fires in the Northwest. You know, with all of these, we are finally seeing the long-predicted acceleration in our own country, not somewhere in the third world where we can ignore it. But the cause of this is exactly, you know, the extraction activities like this huge one that you know, provoked the uprising at Standing Rock that many people are trying to prevent. So what I noticed is that there are some people who are aware of this, and you know, kind of at the ready to kind of raise awareness and take action, you know, in the general society. There are other people who are like hanging back. They may not be hardcore climate deniers who, you know, have been so sort of brainwashed that they, or, you know, poorly educated, they question the science. But, you know, they may believe in it, but not kind of really do much about it. And then when I talk to, you know, indigenous friends and allies, I mean, I just hear a completely different understanding and ground and a perspective on all of this than what is going on in, you know, the rest of the population. I mean, what would you describe as the difference in outlook and where it comes from for indigenous people, where protecting the earth is not like a kind of optional activity that I'll do after I get through the rest of my to-do list?
Right. I think for us, many of our ceremonies and the things that we do as a part of our everyday life or our regular ceremonial spiritual kind of life is all those elements of the earth are already there. So say we go to a nepi or a sweat lodge, we have the stone, we have the wood that heats the stone, we have the birch branches that are used, you know, because they can bend, that create that lodge. There's so many parts of what we do as an everyday or a weekly part of our life that is intricately connected to earth. And that's not even withstanding talking about wind or talking about horses or buffalo or even a prairie dog, you know, which can be a really controversial issue here too. But it I think is just a part of our identity. And so it kind of goes without saying that we have a very, as a group of people, ingrained part of our personality. And in, you know, just like they say that you can inherit trauma, and there's a lot of discussion now about how trauma is intergenerational, and it's actually can be proven to be biochemical and all this other stuff. I think that relationship with the natural state is something that we can inherit as well, and I think it's something that we have inherited.
So that really makes you teachers for the rest of us. So, for example, you know, we might come up with, I'm speaking, you know, as a white American, we might come up with the idea that, you know, let's take kids out into a walk in nature and show them a garden, you know, where food grows. Because, you know, there are people in urban environments, and I'm from the New York City area, and I know, you know, Bob was also, he grew up in the East Coast in New Jersey and all of that. You know, it's like, it's so far away and so disconnected, you know, food is hauled all across the country. You know, many people don't know where it comes from, even when people are healthy food conscious and can afford that type of food. You know, they think it comes from the farmer's market. They don't realize all the sociological factors and social policies and societal decisions that need to happen for there to be healthy food, you know. So there's everything is kind of disconnected, and so people are like, well, let's have, you know, children, let's expose them, let's have them go for a nature walk, let's, you know, and it's not that any of that is wrong. It's just that it is so far and away different from the immersion that is part of your culture, that it makes you teachers for the rest of us if we really care to heal that disconnection that leads to our disrespect and destruction, disrespect for and destruction of the earth. I mean, I guess one of the things that was also happening at Standing Rock is that there were people who intuitively understood, who came, and who wanted to learn. And, you know, so for you as an educator, both of the, you know, children in your community and also of other people through the work you're doing and through Standing Rock. You know, what is it, and you know, that the white civilization needs to, like, learn and know? Like, how would you teach us, given where we are?
Well, I think everybody kind of learns in different ways. And I guess with my experience as a teacher, you always have to remember that people all experience the earth and the world around us, you know, through their strengths and through their weaknesses, too. And mm-hmm. so you have a lot of people that need to feel physically involved, you know, that are really kinesthetic, that are going to go out there and, you know, do things physically, like plant trees, or physically, like, become parts of societies, like the Audubon Society, you know, which leads to protection of birds. Mm-hmm. So there's just different ways, I think, of finding your own passion. And I guess if people could just find at least one passion that connects themselves to the earth or to our natural resources, they could find a lot of different ways to engage, mm-hmm. whether that be, you know, writing letters to congressmen or to congresswomen or to senators, or whether, you know, there's just so many different ways that people mm-hmm. can assist. And even as consumers, we can take a look at, what am I doing as a consumer that is really causing this effect? And even having that conversation around a coffee table with four or five other people and coming to some collective agreements that this is one small change that we can make. And I think if people started to do things like that, then they can use their passion to get involved, to get engaged, and then at the same time continue to educate one another mm-hmm. about even the small things that we can do that will make a long-term difference.
Mm-hmm. You know, that makes a lot of sense. One thing I also notice is that right now, you know, a lot of people that I know are very exercised, exercised and upset and distressed and distraught about the actions of the current president. And certainly, they're horrible. You know, they're awful. And it's not like we should just kind of go ho hum, you know, this too shall pass or something, because it may not pass unless, you know, we
right.
really become deeply engaged about it. But when I talk with some of the Native people I know, it's from their perspective, it's actually not just a sudden eruption where a madman got elected, but part of a more long-standing pattern, that's been true historically. And, you know, when you speak about trauma, Native peoples have been on the receiving end of a traumatizing experience that I think many people are not that aware of. I mean, can you share a little bit with our listeners about that?
I'm sorry, can you rephrase that for me?
Sure, yeah. I mean, historically, like, in a sense, President Trump is a culmination
right.
of a problem. He's not just a sudden, boop, how did he come in here? This couldn't, you know, be. It's kind of part of a long-term historical
right.
trend. Of.
Well, I guess I see society becoming much more apathetic. And, you mm-hmm. know, everybody is so consumed with their schedule, with what they have to get done on the day-to-day. By the end of the day, people are pretty much just catching their breath, you know,
That's
trying
right.
to figure out how they're going to transition and what they need to do to even be set up for the moment they wake up. And
right.
so I think that because of that and other stressors in society, that a lot of people have become to think that their opinion doesn't matter, or
mm-hmm.
that whatever they do, it's not going to count anyway. And
mm-hmm.
so I think there's really a collective apathy that's going on in America mm-hmm. as a whole, because I see it as a microcosm of what's going on with our own politics here, even back on this reservation mm-hmm. in Rosebud, mm-hmm. where people will complain, oh, so-and-so got elected. But then again, when you look at the voter statistics, you realize that only, you know, so much percent of the people even turned out to vote. So I guess just kind of looking at that locally and then on the national level and looking at what we've really created for ourselves for the next few years, mm-hmm. it happened because the wrong people were apathetic and the right people were aggressive. And mm-hmm. so I think that what needs to happen is, you know, these things that happen like Standing Rock, you see the different protests going on across the country, how many people came out into the streets when number 45 was elected. You look at everything that's going on in the news right now, and you just have to hope that people use that action and filter that into ways that will count in the next few years. And that's by mm-hmm. getting out there and voting and mm-hmm. getting out there and making more formal moves in the political community that will hopefully cause us to kind of come back to the center again.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Did you, you know, how did you and your family talk about this growing up? I mean, you know, like how did your Bob and your mom and, you know, how did your family members and your, you know, extended community prepare the young people, and how do you do it now to, you know, kind of survive and maintain hope and be, you know, water and earth protectors in such a troubled society?
Well, I think you have to make things relevant. You know, mm-hmm. they have to be relevant to the younger people, and mm-hmm. you have to be really dynamic in the things that you do with the youth. Because mm-hmm. you're competing with a lot. You're competing mm-hmm. with technology. You're competing with their attention, their social. I mean, there's so much more going on right now than things that happened when I was growing up. You know, mm-hmm. when Bob was there and teaching us different things. And, you know, I learned about Greenpeace from Bob. I learned about so many things that I had never heard about, Amnesty International. I think that, you know, people in generally just haven't found ways to engage, and we need to kind of put those things out there for them and just be good examples if we can.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So, Bob was definitely a good example to me. You know, there's there's a thousand ways in life that I was affected by his ability to parent. And he didn't have to, you know, become a stepdad of three teenagers and a young boy, you know, at the time that he married my mom. But he was just an extraordinary individual. And mm-hmm. once he became part of our lives, there was nothing that was going to stop him from, you know, staying involved. And so I think people need to kind of learn from that if they haven't already, and that, you know, it doesn't matter, but you have to have some tenacity to kind of stay in relationships with people now too, you know, as a part mm-hmm. of that competition that we all go through with our daily lives.
Mm-hmm. You're saying that that even after you grew up, and if, you know, he and your mom maybe were no longer together, if that's what happened, that he also modeled the fact that you don't give up on relationships with people, because, you know, that is kind of what comes first. And, you know, he had the way and the art of doing that without, you know, without cutting people off. He had such a strong sense of value. Can you have any stories, anecdotes of things that you learned from him or saw him doing in action kind of come up for you now or over the last weeks, you know, things you remembered that really, you know, influenced you, or where you know, he was teaching you something and, you know, and it's something that, you know, has kind of stayed with you over time.
Well, I guess there's two really fun memories that I have and I've thought a lot about in the last week. One is when I was young, you know, going to school in the late 80s, early 90s through middle school and high school, you know, you start learning about the different decades. And so we start learning about the 70s, and it occurs to me that my stepfather, who wears these John Lennon glasses, was obviously a hippie at one time, you know. So I remember going to him and asking him, you know, Bob, were you at Woodstock? And he said, yes. He said, I was at Woodstock, but I don't remember very much, my dear, you know. And it was just hilarious, and I remember asking him, so do you remember seeing all the bands? Like, do you remember this? Do you remember that? And he says, you know, I didn't spend a lot of time at the festival. I spent my time along the banks of the river helping people get out of their boats. And
wow.
I think about that, you know, is that he was that kind of person. He was someone that was there and just helped people become a part of what was already going on. And so I really appreciate that memory. The other one I think a lot about is that he was kind of prophetic in the way that he thought. And I remember him telling me one day that he really wanted a chance to look the head of WAPA in the eye and ask them this one certain question. And he was very passionate about what he was saying that day. And I can't remember all of it, but I just remember that he said, I'm going to look the head of WAPA in the eye, and this is what I'm going to say. And it was probably within 6 months where he found himself face-to-face with the head of WAPA. So I never got to find out if he got to say what he wanted to say, but I'm sure he did, you know. So
who was the head of WAPA? What was WAPA?
I don't. It had to do with wind energy, and it had to do with the power lines and the way that power comes across the grid, and you know, just different really in depth things that I probably couldn't understand in one setting. You know, but that was his ability to educate above and beyond what you were capable of understanding. You know, so.
Well, he was modeling something that I don't think too many people learn. And actually, I'm really struck by what you just shared. I was at the People's Summit that was organized this last spring in Chicago with a lot of people that had been and are still ongoing in progressive work with Bernie Sanders and other progressive candidates. And one of the things that really was interesting was that there was a panel of women who were in the media, which included Amy Goodman, Katrina Vandenhuvel, the editor of The Nation magazine, as well as Naomi Klein, the environmental author and activist. And one of the things that they shared was that each one of them had a family member, at least one, sometimes two, who were a role model for taking on a problem and just, you know, being so persistent and not giving up. And this is what kind of was the basis for their, you know, becoming educators, becoming communicators, becoming people who, you know, raise awareness and address these kind of challenges. And so what you've just described is your role model. You know, somebody, Bob was your role model in a way, you know, because he showed you, like, I mean, that story is like, I'm going to do something and, you know, and it's going to happen. And, you know, this belief
right.
that you can, you know, make it happen, which I think a lot of people, more the belief is, oh, it could never happen, and I'm going to go hide and hope it doesn't happen near me, kind of thing, you know?
Right.
That's like gold, isn't it?
Yeah.
Precious, very precious. I mean, have you used that in your own life? You know, have you found yourself in situations where instead of backing off, you kind of walk forward?
Definitely. I mean, every day that I spent at Standing Rock, you know, it was like there's so much to be said about that, you know, and I always used to say when we were at Standing Rock, when you wake up in the morning, you have a plan, and the only thing that you can be sure of will happen is that your plan will change 10 times before noon. And you just had to accept it. I mean, when I first started working, you know, on behalf of the movement, I had this really type A personality way of looking at things, and it didn't take very long, you know, to adapt more of a Bobism, as you would say, you know, the ability to kind of take things in stride and problem solve and, you know, really think ahead of what people around you were thinking about at the time.
Now that's very subtle. That's to be able to do that, you know, in some ways that's tougher than just to sort of, you know, bowl through something, right?
Right.
Like, how did he show you how to do that kind of thing?
You know, like all good teachers, they show you by example. And, you know, I could look at the example of watching him fight the crazy horse malt liquor case. I mean, that was not something that they just went and won. I mean, it took like 10 years. And there was a lot of things that happened and a lot of support that happened to the people who were filing those charges. Bob personally, you know, really took care of people throughout that case as well. And it took that effort. I'm sure that, you know, fighting a pretty much corporation, you don't really think much about winning, but it seemed like he won a lot of cases and he won a lot of things in the courts that maybe people didn't think he could. And so all those times that he could have given up, he didn't. And I watched it time and time and time and time again, and I watched him prevail so many different times that it was just a good modeling of what had to happen.
So if he took a punch, he would regroup and then come back from a different direction, or like he would go out and get
filing. He would just keep with it. I mean, if it meant that you had to file and go back to court or whatever it was, you know, he did it. And so it was really a lot of modeling that I saw throughout my teenage years and into my adulthood that was just that tenacity. There was no way he was going to give up, and you are going to face adversity and you're going to go through hard times, but you got to just keep getting up and keep, you know, moving forward in the legal way to respond. So,
Do you have any idea where he got that from?
Oh, I'm sure it was some good old East Coast grit. You know, he came from, you know, a hardworking family and really great people. I've met his sister and had the opportunity to spend some time with his dad when I was younger, and they were just outstanding people.
Well, when, you know, how often would you, you know, in the last couple of years actually get to see him, or you'd be in touch by phone, or he'd kind of come through, and
Well, Bob was a traveling man. He sometimes told us he was coming, sometimes did not. In the case where he passed here on the Rosebud near my brother's house, I think he was returning for a pit stop or just a couple of days, and got out of his car and walked up the steps to that house that he stays at, and just his ticker, I think, just gave out. And so I think that, you know, we never knew when he was going to come through, but we were always in touch by phone, by email, by when he did come into town, he'd surprise us, give us a call. And so, you know, not the most regular of contact, but that was the kind of person he was. And so he had a lot of relationships, friendships, with people across the United States, in Hawaii, all over the place. And so he is going to definitely be missed by by lots and lots of people who are still finding out about his passing.
So he really died in motion, you know, with his boots on, still traveling, still working, still connecting, still reaching out to people. You know, how do you feel, like, what do you feel that he most, you know, not one thing, but just a couple of things that you think he would most like to be remembered for?
I think that he would like to be remembered for his humor, because he was a really funny guy. And then I think also he would laugh when I would say this to him, but I'd be like, Bob, Dad, I swear if I am ever on Cash Cab and I cannot answer a question, I'm going to call you. Because he just had this breadth of knowledge. And I used to joke about him knowing things that nobody would ever need to know. And he just was that person. He was so incredibly intelligent, but his way to retain information was just, I don't know, incredible. I never met anybody who just knew the amount of trivia that he did. And it came through in his humor. It came through in the way that he related to you and in the way that he explained his experiences in life. And so I think that just really made him a one-of-a-kind person. And I'm absolutely grateful that he came into my life when he did and never gave up on, you know, his role as a father in my life. I do have my birth father. He's always been in my life. You know, no real problems there. But there's such a striking contrast between those two men. And through that contrast, I achieved a balance in my life that I feel like I'm really lucky and fortunate to have.
And you have kids of your own and as well, don't
yep,
you? And
with definitely.
Tell us about your kids.
That's Grandpa Bob to them.
Really?
And he
Aww.
Was, you know, also a wonderful grandfather. So had a lot of grandchildren, actually, with some of my first and second cousins. He was really close with my Uncle Rod, my mom's brother. So they are really missing him, too, right now, you know.
And where in your, you know, the indigenous belief system, you know, is he, you know, if anywhere? I mean, what is your belief system about, you know, where he is or might be, or, you know, what happens when someone passes from this?
Well, he's on his final tour, and, you know, he's really, if people want to look it up, there is a GoFundMe up that's managed by an attorney friend of his that is directly going to cover some of the costs of the actual funeral and some of the travel and stuff that he's taking post-mortem. So he is going from here after he has been cremated. His ashes are going out to New Jersey. They will be hosting a memorial service for him out there. So he's going to be out there for a little bit. And then I think he's going to Hawaii. And then I think he's going to, like, Colorado, and then back here to Rosebud, and then I think finally I don't exactly know how this is all going to happen, but it's going to end up in Wisconsin with some dear friends of ours up there. So he's still making his way around the country, as far as I know, spiritually, and I suppose that he is going to always be where he wants to be. And, you know, that, you know, looking at the way everything happened with the amount of travel that Bob did, I think that we're really fortunate as a family that he came home and that happened really close to us, you know, the kids that he raised, because with the amount of traveling he did, you know, it was always kind of my worst fear that he would end up on some little back road to some little place that only one person knew where he was going, and, you know, and have that ticker of his go out. And so if things had to happen, which they did, I'm really grateful that they happened here close to home on the Rosebud, where I know that he would have wanted to be to start that journey.
Oh, that is beautiful, and that makes so much sense. So he kind of came home, and he's also still, he's still traveling, and so the purpose of the support, the GoFundMe, is to support his last tour. Where do people find that if they would like to contribute?
They can just go on to GoFundMe and probably enter into the search term. I believe they're calling it, what is it, Bob's Final Tour. And then there's a picture of him with his full beard, and his on his finger is some little frog or something. I don't know, but it's So Bob. And I think that was his last profile photo on his Facebook that they used. But, I think it's a good fund. It's definitely not for profit. There are some scholarships that will be set up in his honor if they reach certain goals. So I think that would really be a neat thing for people to at least check out and maybe share it if they can't donate.
Well, that sounds really good. Is there something that, everyone could easily do to support the protection of the earth that Bob was such a leader and a warrior in that line? I mean, what if, everyone who listened to this show and other people could do one thing, what would it be that people could do in his memory to continue, so that
people can continue to educate themselves on what is available in their area, and that they can just really plug in to wherever they're at, and even a small difference is a big difference.
All right, thank you. We have been talking to Lynn Colombe about her late and beloved stepfather, Bob Goff. Come back next week for the next edition of Connect the Dots. And thank you for being with us. I'm Allison Rose Levy. There was me, but there was the sky.